coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Election Day is less than a month away, and voting is already underway under the state's new temporary vote-by-mail system.
It is everyone's unalienable right to vote, and we know we need to get up with the times of how people are able to do that effectively.
Our Roma Battalion and Sophia Schmidt take a closer look at the system Delaware created and voter confidence in it. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also meet the GOP candidates seeking a seat on Wilmington City Council. And we begin a two-part examination of parental voices in the push for education reform in the first state, with a look back at efforts to affect change over the years. Plus, another edition of Arts Playlist. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, Delawareans who already requested vote-by-mail ballots for November's general election started receiving them and could begin filling them out and sending them in. The state's new vote-by-mail system was created in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and has withstood two legal challenges. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has more on the path taken to bring mail-in voting to the first state.
Just a few thousand people voted absentee or by mail in Delaware's 2016 state primary election. This year, nearly 16 times as many did. Even more could vote that way in the general election next month. That's because for the first time, Delawareans can vote by mail without an excuse this year. State Election Commissioner Anthony Albence emphasizes it's one of several ways to vote.
Vote by mail is an option. You know, we have the polling place option available. When the legislators wrote that legislation, that was part of the intention of that was just adding this as an option in addition to polling places.
Delaware's shift is part of a massive expansion of vote-by-mail nationwide amid the pandemic. An NPR PBS and Marist poll last month found 35% of registered voters across the country plan to vote by mail in November. But not everyone's happy with this expansion. Hundreds of lawsuits have been filed across the country against states' vote-by-mail systems over issues like accessibility to disabled voters, ballot return deadlines, and drop boxes. Even in Delaware, this year's temporary vote-by-mail system has faced two legal challenges. The League of Women Voters and the ACLU of Delaware tried to get the deadline to return ballots by mail extended. The state Republican Party tried to get the entire system thrown out, arguing the legislation that established it was unconstitutional. The vote-by-mail law passed this summer was not the first change to Delaware's voting options this year. In March, Governor John Carney used his coronavirus emergency order to expand one of the traditional absentee voting excuses, sick or physically disabled, to include anyone impacted by the coronavirus. That effectively allowed every registered Democrat or Republican in Delaware to vote by mail, email, and for a time an internet voting platform in July's presidential primary, and prompted an unprecedented level of absentee voting that election. The vote-by-mail legislation passed this summer sought to make it even easier for Delawareans to vote remotely this year. Here's the lead sponsor, House Majority Leader Valerie Longhurst, at a virtual bill signing in July.
Voting is a right and it's not a privilege, and we should never have to choose between our health or the right to vote. And House Bill 346 is a bill that will help all Delawareans to stay safe.
The legislation directed the Department of Elections to send vote-by-mail applications to all primary and general voters who hadn't already chosen to vote absentee. Voters can also apply for a mail-in ballot online. Voters can return their mail-in ballots by postal mail or place them in one of five secure drop boxes statewide. Mail-in votes must be received by election officials by the close of polls on Election Day. Unlike in some states, ballots postmarked by Election Day but received later cannot be counted. The Delaware Republican Party sued the state to try to block vote by mail before the November election. Julia Klein represented the GOP at a chancery court hearing last month. She argued that vote by mail is not absolutely necessary to the continuity of government and is therefore unconstitutional.
All the polling places were open. We did have a mechanism, a constitutional mechanism, namely absentee voting in place, which was, you know, as simple as people going online, clicking a button and requesting.
Vice Chancellor Sam Glasscock rejected that argument. He wrote that maintenance of polling places with volunteer staff is itself a government function. And with the coronavirus at large, that function is threatened by massive in-person voting. The deadline to return mail-in ballots was at the heart of a Delaware League of Women Voters and ACLU of Delaware lawsuit. They argued that even voters abiding by vote-by-mail deadlines may not have their votes counted. Voters can request a mail-in ballot as little as 4 days before the election, the last day officials can send ballots out. The Department of Elections recommends voters send applications in at least a week before the election, but the U.S. Postal Service recommends voters mail ballots back by that point. David Fry represented the League of Women Voters before a Chancery Court judge earlier this week.
There are people who can engage in a good faith process to understand what the deadlines are, when they need to request their ballot, how early they need to vote, and believe they're following the process in good faith and still have their votes not count because they show up too late.
Fry argued this violates the free and fair elections and right to vote clauses of Delaware's Constitution. But Vice Chancellor Glasscock questioned where the line should be drawn.
There were always people who needed to rely on absentee balloting in order to have their votes registered. I'm struggling to understand. So it was constitutional, even though some people were being disenfranchised. Now it's unconstitutional, and you're saying it's more than just more people are liable to be disenfranchised. I'm just struggling a little bit to see how that works.
Glasscock rejected the League of Women Voters and ACLU's challenge Friday. Election Commissioner Anthony Albans has declined to weigh in on whether the mail-in ballot return deadline should be extended to make sure all votes are counted.
Our philosophy is looking at the way the law is now is just encouraging people to be as prudent as they can to get stuff in as early as they can.
More than 800 mail-in ballots, or around 1%, went uncounted during the primary election last month because they arrived after the close of polls. Mike Brickner, executive director of the ACLU of Delaware, said during a Get Out the Vote webinar late last month, his concerns with changes Postmaster General Louis DeJoy instituted this summer.
If you've been paying attention to what's going on with the U.S. Postal Service right now and all of the tricks and hijinks that many people in the federal government are using right now to slow down the mail, we're seeing where that is endangering our right to vote by mail.
Federal judges have recently ruled to stop these changes. The Postal Service says it has a robust and tested process for proper handling and timely delivery of election mail. Kimberly Johnson is a resident of Newark who's been unemployed during the pandemic. Johnson tried to vote by mail during the state primary in September.
But every time I went to mail it in, the mailbox has just been like overstuffed outside of the post office. And I wasn't aware of the ballot drop boxes in time. So I went in person and voted, and they just like voided that out and had me vote in person.
Johnson says even after this experience, she plans to vote by mail for the general election.
I'm immunocompromised, so the idea of standing in that long line, which I'm sure will be even longer for the general election, I'm definitely more for vote by mail. I just know, like, to either mail it out super early, do it right away, or use the election offices, have drop boxes you can put them in. And so I'm probably just going to utilize that.
State elections officials, lawmakers, and others will be watching how vote-by-mail works for voters like Johnson this year to see whether it should be made a permanent option. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. Some of that assessment of the mail-in voting system is already happening in the wake of the state's September primary. Most who chose to vote in person during that primary said they didn't trust the new system. And Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia looked into efforts to build more confidence in it.
If primary trends hold, Delaware can expect more than 15 times the amount of mail-in ballots this year than in any previous year. Overall turnout increased by double digits for both the Democratic and Republican parties in the 2020 primary compared to 2016. This can be attributed in part to a more contentious primary, but the access of vote-by-mail ballots was also likely a major factor. Still, many Delawareans assumed the health risk posed by the coronavirus pandemic and cast a ballot in person because they distrust vote-by-mail. Richard Delian, a Democrat in Milford, was one of many who wasn't sure his vote would be counted by mail.
With everything that's going on with the USPS, I felt that maybe my vote might have been late or something. You never know what might happen, so I felt safer doing it in person.
He's talking about the recent controversies over service cuts and sorting machine removals at the USPS, which could cause delays in delivering ballots to and from voters. His sentiment was one shared by Democratic and Republican voters alike. But the state parties disagree on the system. State GOP party chair Jane Brady opens the door for fraud.
Why would you introduce a new system this close to an election where people are not familiar with it and they're sending things in unsigned and incomplete or not getting them there on time and they're disenfranchised as a result. Why are you inviting fraud, potential fraud, into our elections?
There have been no identifiable cases of voter fraud stemming from vote by mail in September's primary. In fact, a Heritage Foundation database documenting voter fraud found no voter fraud cases in the first state since they started the database in the 1980s. There have been only 1,298 documented cases nationwide in the past four decades, and most aren't about mail-in voting. Not everyone in the GOP party is against vote by mail. State Representative Mike Smith, a Newcastle County Republican in a district with more registered Democrats than Republicans, abstained from the vote by mail legislation, but says that doesn't mean he's against it.
I went not voting for several reasons. One, we didn't need it for this election because we're in a state of emergency. And under state of emergency, you're allowed to no reason absentee vote. So you are already able to do the mail-in ballot process. Now, long term, I think mail-in ballots would be a great thing. Because, you know, you work out all the kinks ahead of time.
This divide over vote by mail didn't always exist. Utah, a heavily Republican state, created an optional vote by mail system back in 2012. In other states where vote by mail is now the only option, both Republican and Democratic leadership support it. Jesse Chatterton is the executive director of the Democratic Party of Delaware. He thinks vote by mail would not be as controversial if it weren't for the Trump administration.
Although I would say that Republicans in states like Utah, Oregon, and Washington have gotten in line with it before Donald Trump was the sinister force that was sort of guiding their party. And I think, unfortunately, the Republican Party here in Delaware is just following his cue cards when it comes to this sort of manufactured outrage.
The total increase in turnout in the 2020 primary was very similar between Democrats and Republicans. Dems saw a 90% increase to Republicans' 85%. But looking at just the increase in voting by mail, Democrats voted by mail in far greater numbers than Republicans. In fact, turnout in person decreased for Democrats by 4%, but increased by mail over 1,890%. For Republicans, in-person turnout increased 50% and saw a jump of 717% in absentee voting. The two sides do agree on ways to improve the vote-by-mail system in this election, and maybe future ones. According to data from the Department of Elections, 1,024 ballots were rejected during the September primary because they either arrived late or they weren't signed, and the Elections Department couldn't follow up with the voter in time. Republican candidate for Governor Julianne Murray isn't surprised ballots arrived late.
The biggest problems are, number one, people not getting it in by the deadline, and number two, that they fill it out wrong. And, and the not getting it in by the deadline, the Postal Service is, doing what they can with it. But because of the timing that they have ascribed to this, how late you can request a ballot, why somebody would wait until the week before the election to even make the request is beyond me. But they do. And they did.
Educating voters was the major priority for increasing trust in vote by mail. Murray herself didn't know when applying for a vote-by-mail ballot online, voters must either print out the application to sign it or enter their driver's license information to pull their signature from the DMV. As Chatterton mentions, when people warm up to voting by mail and see it as safe, secure, and convenient, he's sure the vast majority of Delawareans will support it. Chatterton is confident if vote-by-mail is successful this year, the state legislature will move to make it permanent.
So I am hopeful that, after we thoughtfully study what happened in 2020 with this sort of trial program, that we can put together, long-term legislation that encapsulates best practices, not only here in Delaware, but as you mentioned, in other states where this has been happening for 10 and 20 years, and make sure that Delawareans have this opportunity long-term.
Even Republicans who have been against vote by mail, like Murray, expect it to become a staple in Delaware's elections from now on. She says they might as well accept that fact and help voters learn how to fill out and send their mail-in ballots. Roman Battaglia, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Roman. And a reminder, you can check out all of Delaware Public Media's 2020 election coverage anytime at delawarepublic.org. And that coverage continues next with a look at the GOP candidates battling for a seat on Wilmington City Council. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. down ballot on Election Day in November is a race for 4 at-large positions on Wilmington City Council. The city charter allows no more than 3 to come from one political party. And since registered Democrats heavily outnumber Republicans in Wilmington, the 3 Democrats on the ballot are likely to earn seats. That leaves 3 GOP candidates hoping to become, in all likelihood, the only Republican on city council. Delaware Public Media contributor Mark Fowler has more on this race.
One of those Republican candidates is the incumbent, Cyril Adams, who won by just 11 votes after a recount in 2016, 4 years after he ran and lost. Adams says he pursued a spot on council thanks in part to something his grandmother once told him, if you see a problem, fix it. Adams is a CPA by profession, and he points to his pro-business voting record.
I feel that we overregulate business quite often here in the city, and you want businesses to pick Wilmington to work in, okay, not Newcastle County.
But why should a business consider locating in Wilmington instead of the outlying areas? Adams says there are challenges to attracting jobs, but they can be overcome.
The biggest thing that holds us back here in the city is a talent pool. And actually, the genesis of every problem in the city of Wilmington is the lack of a Wilmington school district.
Calvin Brown of Hilltop is also in the race. He lives above his barbershop and across the street from a church where he is a pastor.
I spend a lot of time in social issues, working with community, young people, church events. And I'm just trying to, I think, insert some civility as well as some leadership in the city council.
Brown says he's given back to the community by reviving Hilltop Community Day, sponsoring youth sports activities, and working with Westside Grows Together to install new lighting. If he joins city council, Brown says one of the first things he wants to do is load his colleagues and Mayor Persicki onto a bus and visit all parts of the city.
When you go back to make legislative changes and introduce bills, you'll get a picture with words, and so then you'll be less likely to just suggest things that you've never seen. So I wanted to take them around. I want to walk these streets. What we're asking the police to do, I think we can improve the climate for law enforcement to do a better job.
Rounding out the trio of Republican candidates is James Spadola, executive director of Read Aloud Delaware. Spadola has chaired the Board of Commissioners of the Wilmington Housing Authority and is president of his local civic association. He explains why he's running.
It's a natural extension of the work I've been doing in the city. And two, I think we need desperate change on city council. Desperate change. I mean, it's, we need pragmatic and reasonable people on there that can move the city forward and not focus on their own ego.
Spadola says he's been able to develop and maintain good relationships with members of the state legislative delegation.
You know, I'm somebody who's had great relationships with Republicans, Democrats, Independents, because they know I'm an ideas over party type of guy.
All 3 GOP candidates have service backgrounds. Adams in the Marine Corps, Brown in the Air Force, and Spadola with the U.S. Army. Spadola also was a Newark police officer, where he and his partner carried a sign offering free hugs. The Hug a Cop video went viral. Spadola says that's valuable perspective he would bring to council, as Wilmington, like many urban areas nationwide, faces escalating rates of crime and violence. He says you can't have public safety without criminal justice reform, and that many unlawful or excessive uses of force seem to stem from minor encounters. Brown, raised in Riverside, says part of the solution to violence lies in education, and he believes city council should lobby the state for more resources to improve the climate in the city for law enforcement to do a better job. Adams also believes the violence is connected to education, specifically the lack of a Wilmington school district. And while he describes himself as a law and order guy, he supports some police reform like broader adoption of body cameras and allowance of no-knock warrants only in rare circumstances. Spadola is concerned about Wilmington's short and long-term budget challenges as more people work from home and there are fewer things happening to lure visitors.
One, you have the immediate revenue hit on the city wage, but that's less people coming to the city to go to Market Street. So the arts are the almost the last resort in that regard. We need the arts to keep people coming into the city.
Brown, who grew up with 14 brothers and sisters on Wilmington's East Side, remembers a time when there were 5 movie theaters downtown and people wanted to be in the city. He praises Mayor Persicki's leadership on riverfront development even before he took office, but believes more is possible.
And I think that we've got to do not only develop business, but we got to develop the cultural, the arts, and make the city something that you want to live in.
And Adams adds, unless someone feels safe and secure, they may not want to live in or visit Wilmington. As a fiscal conservative, Adams also suggests government in many cases should identify an issue, find the best people to deal with it, and stay out of the way.
Government's supposed to be a facilitator. It's not supposed to be a provider. It's not supposed to be overbearing, overregulation, socialist concept. No. Mm-hmm. No. Remember, you're talking to the conservative Republican here, okay? Other people might have different color stripes. Mm-hmm. I don't.
All three Republicans would be happy to see more than one GOP candidate get elected, but realize the odds are against that. Spadola, who ran for state auditor 2 years ago and filed for this race nearly 1 year ago, says even through COVID, he's trying to engage with the voters.
But yeah, now we're out and about. And, you know, again, I'm not somebody who's new to Wilmington. People think I'm on council already. Aside from knocking on doors, campaigning to me is doing what I would have been doing anyway.
Adams, meanwhile, seeks to balance his schedule of council and committee meetings while rounding up voter support to continue serving a city he's passionate about.
Hey, it's a beautiful place. Okay, take a walk around. I don't care where you walk at. Okay, we have a beautiful city and we have nice people here. And so, hey, why wouldn't you want to live in a beautiful place with nice people? Yes, I'm very passionate about the city. I love the city of Wilmington.
And Brown, who previously ran for State House of Representatives and Newcastle County Council, says this race feels like the right fit for him.
Running for office has been a lot for me, but I think right now this is the best opportunity for me because this is closer to all of my experiences, is that I'm a city boy. And the one thing I do know is Wilmington, Delaware.
Ronnell Page has also filed for Wilmington City Council at large as an independent Party of Delaware candidate. Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Mark. And the Green continues in a moment with the first of a two-part series examining the role of parental voices in advocacy for education reform in the first state. Then and now. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. When we talk about efforts to address education issues in the first state, we often focus on school leaders, Department of Education officials, lawmakers, or the groups created by them, like the Reading Consortium. But there are others trying to make a difference, parents, private citizens, and grassroots groups that advocate for change. Over the next 2 weeks, Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nangest is looking at that latter group, then and now. What their efforts to steer a new course for education look like, and what they've learned along the way. This week, Larry checks in with some who've been fighting the fight since the 1970s, when desegregating schools was the focus of the battle. And he joined me earlier this week to reflect on what he learned about their efforts. So a lot of issues surrounding education and the ability of parents and others to advocate for kids, especially in Wilmington, starts with desegregation in the 1970s. And your piece calls that the beginning of marginalization of parents. How so?
Well, you know, back in the 70s, and when Wilmington was a single school district, there were a lot of parent organized groups. There were home and school associations. There was an advocacy group just for parents of the Title I program, which was the federal aid, Head Start, and all that sort of stuff. So it was very vibrant parent involvement in the school community at the time. So now, when you come to desegregation, all of the issue here, it starts with the numbers that were associated with student assignments. We had 11 school districts in northern Newcastle County, 10 in the suburbs plus Wilmington, and they were merged into one. And at that time, the suburban schools accounted for a little bit more than 70% of the total enrollment. So about 70% of the available seats were in the suburbs. Now, you do the math when you start splitting up students in grades 1 through 12, and you wind up having to put the kids in suburban schools for 9 years and in city schools for 3, if you're going to balance this out. And so now let's look at the consequences for parents in terms of things like going to meetings and events at their children's schools. Now, something that's very significant but often forgotten is that this arrangement made Wilmington residents, students and parents alike, minorities in the very schools that they had considered their own for many years, schools that had been the source of neighborhood pride for a generation, sometimes even longer than that. And now the local residents represented no more than 25% to 30% of that particular school's demographic. Now, Jeff Rafael, who's a retired University of Delaware professor, whose book that he wrote in 1980 on the politics of school desegregation remains really the best history of the events from the 70s. He recalls the first time that he went to one of these citizens' committee meetings at the Wilmington school that his daughter had been assigned to attend. And he walked into the room and he saw six people there, and all of them were white PhDs that he knew lived in the suburbs. So as you can see, even though these were Wilmington schools, the fact was that the suburbanites were there and had sort of majority status. And now getting to suburban schools for Wilmington parents was even a bigger problem, because many of them relied on public transportation in a period when very few buses ran at night. So if the parents could get out to the schools, then they often felt uncomfortable interacting with large numbers of suburban parents. Again, 2/3 to 3/4 of the school's population in the suburbs was white. And these suburban parents, for the most part, were, you know, not particularly enthusiastic about desegregation occurring.
Now, your piece also notes that the changing nature of the desegregation plan over time also had an impact. In what way?
Well, again, in 1978, the desegregation plan created one district, a single school district for all of Newcastle County. Now, all of northern Newcastle County. Now, people, especially in the suburbs, didn't like that arrangement. They thought that this single district was too big and not responsive to their needs, their interests, and so on. So in 1981, that big district was split into the four districts that we now have. And, you know, this was really a better arrangement for suburban parents, but it went even further in minimizing the influence of parents who lived in Wilmington. Now, there were a lot of issues that were important to Wilmington parents in those days. Black students were more likely to be suspended or placed in special education classes, for example. And there were community advocates who would bring up these issues at school board meetings. Now, when you divide that single district into four, you're also dividing up those advocates. And now they had to deal with four different school boards that were meeting in different locations, and sometimes these school boards were actually meeting on the same night. So these decisions that were being made by courts, by government agencies, was fractionalizing the parents within the city of Wilmington.
Fast forward to the 1990s and beyond, the lifting of the desegregation order and the state's choice and charter school laws, plus the Neighborhood Schools Act in 2000. All changed the equation again. How did they serve to stifle parental influence further? It seems it may have prompted some parents to focus more on their own personal situation rather than systemic issues.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, a couple of different things happened here. Now, with the lifting of the court desegregation order, school boards started to reassign suburban students to schools closer to their homes. The choice law accelerated the process and gave parents more options. Now you could apply to attend pretty much any school you wanted as long as it had enough seats. Now the launch of charter schools then created even more options. And these options, however, worked better for suburbanites because of the transportation issues. Again, school buses, they ran on routes that were designed for neighborhood schools. So if you choiced into a different school or decided to go to a charter, that meant that you usually had to get to a bus stop outside your neighborhood for your student. And this was a much easier option for, you know, two-car suburban families than it was for low-income Wilmington residents who relied on public transportation. And so you've got that issue, and the things that we've talked about before about the parents having difficulty getting to meetings at night, that is further compounded because of this fractionalization that's going on. So what do we get? We get resegregation. City schools are once again becoming overwhelmingly minority in their enrollments, and in the suburbs, as you indicated, parents are more comfortable with the schools that their children are attending. And when you have that increased comfort level, it meant that parents were less likely to become involved in those schools because they didn't have to go to school board meetings and so on to fight for additional programs and services for their kids, because after all, they chose these schools because they had already were already offering the programs and the services that they wanted.
And ultimately, by the early to mid-2000s, was there a bottoming out of those parental voices based on what you just said? I mean, I recall in the Markell administration, there was a push early on parental engagement. Had many parents, to some degree, just kind of given up or checked out?
Well, you know, again, in the suburbs, parents are feeling less of this need to be engaged, and especially here in that the last decade, the enrollment in charter schools has, you know, really, really jumped up. Now, in the city, the splintering that we've talked about intensified as the number of charter schools in the city grew as well. You had more charters opening up in the city. I remember Edison and Kumba and Moyer and Eastside, Prestige, a few others, and every time one of them would open, it would drain more students from the traditional public schools. And now, as we've said, when parents opt to put their children in charters, they're making a choice. And from that, you can logically infer that the parents that remain in the traditional schools, the students that remain in the traditional schools, are the ones whose parents are less interested in education issues. Now, giving up might not be the right phrase to use, but what you do have here is you've got parents who are struggling with so many issues, with employment, with buying food, paying rent, and that increasing not violence in the neighborhoods. And these things all make becoming active in their children's schooling less of a overwhelming need for them.
Having walked through the history now, what issues that plagued parents and their children then are still here today? And are there many points of deja vu?
Well, yeah, most definitely. I mean, many of the themes have remained the same, but the details tend to be a little bit different. You know, for instance, one of the overriding issues back in the 1970s was whether the students in Wilmington schools were receiving the same quality of education as were the children who were in suburban schools. You know, so that was the issue then. Now the question is, how do we provide low-income students, minority students, English learners, with the supports that they need to perform as well as their middle-class peers? So it's not strictly a city-suburb issue now. It's a little bit more of one that's dictated by wealth and demographics, but it's the same general theme. Likewise, pay differentials between city and suburban teachers led to a teacher strike in the very first months of desegregation. Now, the issue today is a little bit different. What we have now is that the least experienced, lowest paid teachers are the ones who are more likely to be working in the schools where students have the greatest academic needs. And then you've got some issues that, quite the same now as they were 30, 40 years ago, in particular the disproportionate suspension rates for minority students.
These issues that you've mentioned have been brought up in several reports, commissions, committees over the past 15 years or so. What sort of impact have those reports, commissions, and committees had?
In terms of getting anything done, very little. For the most part, these reports, which actually go back as far as 1984, are gathering dust. Our proposals to provide weighted funding to schools serving students with the greatest needs and to reduce the number of school districts serving Wilmington won the support of the State Board of Education in 2016. That was about as far as anything got. But a state budget shortfall and opposition from suburban lawmakers that year killed that plan in the General Assembly, and it hasn't been revived since then. Now, you asked earlier about parents giving up. I think more to the point, they've become worn out. They've been exhausted by seeing report after report that examines problems and recommends solutions, and then they stand by helplessly as the people who do have the power to make changes do very little to implement the recommendations in all these reports.
And how optimistic are those people who have advocated in years past that there's perhaps an opportunity for more progress today than they saw previously?
Well, the folks who have been in the forefront of these issues for years are still hopeful, although they, you know, they certainly wish that they had been able to accomplish more so that we wouldn't have to be fighting these same battles over and over again for 40 years. You know, right now, it's not clear how much a new round of parent advocacy would contribute to a solution, but there is some hope that the system will finally start working in favor of the advocates of reform. We've got the Reading Consortium for Educational Equity, and this is the latest iteration of all of these commissions that we've seen in the last 10 years or so. The Reading Commission is due to make recommendations next year on funding improvements and for restructuring the school systems that serve Wilmington. We've also got a school finance lawsuit pending, and that could change the funding formulas for how the state allocates funds for education, and it could also bring reassessments of real estate for tax purposes statewide. We're also likely to have a few more progressive voices in the Delaware General Assembly after next month's election, joining a couple of strong education advocates who were elected 2 years ago. So I guess, as I've said often enough on these programs before, we'll just have to wait and see.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece on those working on education reform for decades is available at DelawarePublic.org. And next week, he'll be back with a closer look at education advocacy today. And stay with us. We wrap up The Green Next with Arts Playlist and a look at a virtual art exhibition put on by Pachamantaris. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A 53-year-old Wilmington-based Peace and Justice nonprofit is showcasing its new virtual art museum. Delaware Pachamantaris created it for its fifth annual Visionary Peace Youth Art Exhibition. The group's executive director, Shara Smith, says the museum contains peace-related art created by more than 300 elementary, middle, and high school students from over 25 public, private, and charter schools across Delaware, as well as various community organizations. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Smith speaks with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the exhibition and its impact.
Talk to me about some background about Delaware Pachamantaris.
Pachamantaris, it means peace on earth, and we've been in the Wilmington community for 53 years. And the idea is basically that we have a grassroots approach to peace building. And what that means is that peace is not something that is created in some far-off place that is disconnected from the daily lives of regular people in communities. And so the fundamental principle that we are founded on and that we truly believe in is that regular folks like you and me can roll up their sleeves and have a part in building peace, creating peace in society. And so over the decades, what we've done as an organization, we've implemented programming, depending on what the major issues were at the time, but we've implemented programming that is meant to directly respond to the needs of society in that moment and given members of the community an opportunity to be a part of that. Today, we have our Visionary Peace Art Program, which is our headliner program that really utilizes the arts as a way of helping people to connect to their deeper sense of humanity and to express their vision for peace in their community, their neighborhood.
You know, Shara, we frequently hear the term peace on earth. How important is your organization in 2020 with everything happening?
You know, I think every day you turn on the TV, you turn on the radio, you pick up a newspaper, and there's more bad news, especially in 2020. I think that we've all been saturated with just turmoil that's happening in our society. And we firmly believe at Pachem that now is the time to really lean in and to really be bold in the work that we're doing when it comes to peace. And that's why we've taken the approach that we've taken to our Youth Peace Art Program at a time when a lot of organizations were scaling back and contracting the work that they were doing. We decided to expand, and it's specifically because we felt very strongly that this moment in our society is the time when we need to really dig deep. So instead of scaling back our work, we expanded it and created this beautiful virtual art museum and gave young people an opportunity to really express what this moment is like for them and what their vision is for transforming it into the type of society, the type of community that they feel they deserve and they want to see for their futures.
All right, so now that we have the background about Delaware Pachamon Terrace, let's talk about the fact that you're announcing the opening of your virtual art museum for the 5th Annual Visionary Peace Youth Art Exhibition. Tell me about the Virtual Art Museum.
We're very proud of it. And, you know, when we had the conversation of how do we respond in this moment, we talked about the possibility of not doing anything this year. But again, we said, now's the time, right? Now we should really lean in. So how can we utilize technology? How can we utilize various technological tools to create the experience of walking into an art museum and seeing all these wonderful works of art created by young people from Delaware? And so that led to us creating that space, that virtual space that could house the work from our youth. And so we reached out to various partners in the community. We have more than 25 public, private, and charter schools, as well as community organizations that participated in working with their youth to encourage them to submit pieces for the exhibition. We had approximately 50 teachers and coordinators participate as well in encouraging the youth, and that resulted in over 300 pieces of artwork from youth around Delaware to support the virtual art museum. So we're pretty excited about it.
Wow. So students between the ages of 5 and 18, that's a wide range, 5 and 18, were asked to draw, paint, or create a digital image showing their vision of a peaceful world, or answering the question, what does peace look like to you? Tell me about some of the artwork. Did the artwork range by age group? I mean, what does peace look like to a 5-year-old is going to be different from what does peace look like to an 18-year-old, right?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. So you are going to see a difference in the pieces that are submitted. And the vision that gets articulated in some of the pieces, it does look very different from a 5-year-old versus an 18-year-old. But even in looking at the pieces from some of our younger participants, you see certain themes depicted in those pieces. You see certain things like harmony. You see certain themes like inclusion depicted in their pieces. One of the pieces that was submitted by one of our younger participants showed playing at the beach with her friends, and her friends come from all different walks of life. And so to her, that represented peace. And so I feel like that is such a strong message for us to hear right now and to have that communicated to us from the eyes of a young person. And then we had some pieces from our teenagers. I had one piece in particular really struck me. It was a sea of blue. And it looked like a tunnel a little bit. And I was staring at it for a moment and thinking to myself, what am I looking at here? What is this artist trying to convey? And then it dawned on me that I was looking at the inner part of a wave. And it was a perspective on a wave that you would never, ever see unless you were on a surfboard surfing a wave. And so I asked the artist, why did you choose this to communicate peace? And she said, well, the reason why is because I used to be really afraid of surfing. I never in a million years thought that I would be that person who gets out on a surfboard and goes out into the ocean. But I started to do it. And as a result, I was able to see these different perspectives of the ocean that can only happen when you're on a surfboard. And she said, that represents this moment for us in society. There are certain perspectives that we will never see unless we have the courage to do something we didn't think we could do. So I'm very excited about the art museum, and I definitely would encourage your listeners to take a look and just take a moment to process each piece and what each young person is trying to communicate to us.
Let's remind everybody we're talking to Shara Smith. Shara is the executive director of Delaware Pachaman Terrace, and we're talking about the virtual art museum for the 5th Annual Visionary Peace Youth Art Exhibition. The opening of this virtual museum comes really at a difficult time for all of Delaware, given the high rate of gun violence in cities like Wilmington. And despite many of these young children that are participating in this project, they've created stunning works of art that really address both violence and systemic racism. And as you just said, adults could really learn from the compassion that they have for their communities, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you brought that up because, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's easy for people to think, you know, what does this have to do with peace? And part of our approach, you know, Pachaman is an organization that has always pushed for practical approaches to peace, things that regular everyday people can engage in that contribute to peace. And that's based on that fundamental concept that peace is not something that is created in some far off place. Peace is what we do every day. It's how we treat the person in front of us. And our youth art program specifically focuses on encouraging young people to visualize and then actualize that vision for peace in society. And so the idea behind that is if you can't see it, then how can you create it? And so the practice of envisioning and then taking action to create it is something that we think is really critical to creating peace. And you talked about how in March, you know, our world changed. And, you know, I think all of this year, there's just been so much happening to all of us and for all of us. And it certainly can lead to, you know, feelings of apathy or worse, right? And so how do we find those opportunities to create something different? And that's really what our focus is as an organization. We want to make sure that we're giving people those opportunities to create the type of community they want to see, as opposed to having all of their energy sucked in to the things that we don't want to see about our society, that are harmful, that hurt us. You know, it's important for us to keep our eyes open and to acknowledge the reality, but to not disengage from creating the type of community, the type of society that we want to see, that we feel we deserve, and that our children deserve. So not only have we been focused on this wonderful virtual art museum, we also utilized our art program to create a space for people to voice their frustration and their concern about systemic racism and injustice in society. And we also created a virtual art gallery out of that project as well, and that was called the Listen to My Art Virtual Art Gallery. And so adults from the community were able to take that moment of frustration and grief and anger and the variety of other issues that they were, you know, experiencing and thinking and feeling, and create works of art that were designed to create a dialogue. So we had, you know, this amazing gallery called Listen to My Art that was created and then we put online, and then we had dialogues based on the pieces that were submitted to this specific exhibition. And it was fantastic. We know that these things work. And the fact that we are creating these unique ways for people to have conversations and to talk about what peace looks like and what is our path forward, that lets us know that this is the work that we need to be doing. So we're very proud of it.
Shara, how can my listeners tour the Virtual Art Museum? Where do they go?
So if your listeners go to Facebook and search for Delaware Pachaman in Terrace, that's Pacem in Terrace, Terris, they will find our Facebook page. And again, we put all of the links to our exhibitions, to the virtual art gallery for youth peace art. Everything is on the Facebook page, and they can check out not only those activities that I just mentioned, but also we have a new exhibit coming up, and this one's going to be a photography exhibition, and it's called Generations for Racial Justice. And this exhibition is going to showcase images in the struggle for racial justice across multiple generations. So we're accepting photos for that right now. And again, all of those details are on our Facebook page.
Thanks to Delaware Pachamon Terrace Executive Director Shara Smith and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Mark Fowler and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.